biggest COVID-induced hole in many sportsmad South Africans' lives right now is undoubtedly sport. About the best we have is the redoubtable sports commentator Andrew Cotter's hilarious calling of his two Labradors, Mabel and Olive. But the sad reality is that over three quarters of sports federations surveyed by South African Sports Confederation and Olympic Committee, SASCOC, believes they won't survive longer than 6 months under the current COVID-19 lockdown restrictions. That emerged from the respondents to SASCOC's SA Sport Day Zero survey. And this weekend, all football fans, I think, are going to become Bundesliga fans when Germany's top two football leagues resume tomorrow. We've got Borussia Dortmund taking on Schalke, their local rivals in the Ruhr region, behind closed doors. And I think, like many professional sporting competitions around the world, the Bundesliga has been halted for months. So sports organisers here in South Africa will be watching it and a handful of other events around the world to see if they too can kick off behind closed doors. We saw a report by accounting firm PwC a few years ago put the value of the South African sports industry at just over 15 billion rand. That was in 2016. And it used just five key criteria, though. We had gate revenue, media broadcast rights, sponsorships, merchandising, and sports betting. It didn't account for the numerous cottage industries in the ecosystem. In tennis, for example, there are hundreds of coaches nationally who work at schools and clubs who have been unemployed since the lockdown began. So it's a big issue in the country. It's certainly not reflected in Tennis South Africa's financial statements that we have all of these knock-on effects. So what is the state of play for sport to resume in the country, and what is the financial impact of having clubs and codes closed for months on end? Let's welcome our Zoom room to discuss. Firstly, Mark Alexander, President of SA Rugby. We've got Jacques Fall, Acting CEO of Cricket South Africa, Marissa Langeni, CEO of SA Hockey, and Richard Glover, CEO of Tennis South Africa. So many of the big ones, unfortunately, we invited football. They're still busy arguing behind closed doors. There are obviously different layers to all of this. From a financial point of view, the most obvious is what footing the federations are on with the main broadcaster, SuperSport. MultiChoice is in a closed period ahead of its results, so couldn't join us. Mark, kick us off here. As rugby is the biggest headache being a winter sport at the moment, what's the current state of play at SARU?
I think this pandemic has highlighted that rugby is first and foremost in the entertainment business. Because of all our income is strictly linked to eyeballs of professional teams taking the field. Almost 100% of income can be attributed to professional rugby. So, you know, one looks at our revenue, 56% of our revenue comes from broadcast, 27% from sponsorship, and 15% from match and events. So without us taking the field, rugby could be bankrupt by December.
That is the bottom line. We need to ensure that we get players back onto the field in order to ensure that rugby can survive. World Rugby has released protocols around how to return to the game safely. What is SARU's thinking with regards to restarting the Currie Cup, for example?
We done a presentation to the Minister of Sport and his team, and wanted to get back to play behind closed stadiums. We also presented the World Rugby protocol and our own protocols that we developed. You know, some of the protocols looks at daily symptoms and temperature checks for players, team management, other officials involved in the competition, stringent hygienic cleaning of the facilities, which are the buses, the stadia, and the hotels. Contact tracing principles and policies we put in place. And we asked, you know, part of our policy will be asking players, officials, or people involved in the delivery of the game to stay away if they're not feeling well. Self-isolation to be tested. So there are big protocols around this, having the events at closed stadiums. So we presented that to government. The minister will present it to his task team and to the COVID command center.
And in terms of the conversations you're having with sponsors and broadcasters, would they be satisfied broadcasting games that don't have any fans in the stadia? I know there are all kinds of innovations happening around the world, some using AI technology to beam virtual spectators into the stadia, other in Korea are just putting up placards where you can actually pay for your face to be up on a placard. What are we thinking with regards to the way we innovate to get around this?
I think there's a lot of other innovation tools that will come into play with the broadcasters to give the sponsors and the broadcaster the next mileage they want. It's all about content here. We need to create content to give to the sponsors. Without the content, the sponsors will start to get clawing back the revenue that they will be paying for our product.
And that is the bottom line here. We'll come back to what players are saying and thinking about this as well. Jacques, it hasn't been very long that you've had your feet under the desk at Cricket South Africa, but already we see a change in sentiment. The conversation with the players' union, SACA, seems to have certainly improved that relationship after some tumultuous period with Cricket South Africa. You're fortunate in that your season is just coming to an end, though. How is Cricket South Africa being impacted by COVID-19?
Yeah, good afternoon. Thank you. We did have challenges even before the coronavirus, so we could have done probably without it as well. But we are fortunate in that it hit us at the end of the season, and we now have the off-season at hand. But we will be impacted. I think we're all in the same storm, just probably at a different phase. August is our due date, so we've got an incoming tour, international Indian tour, and that makes up the bulk of our broadcast revenue. And should that not take place or not take place within this financial year, then it'll have a big impact. But also playing behind closed doors has got a different impact. We're working closely with the ECB. They are ahead of us in terms of the crisis in that they're in their cricket season. So we're benchmarking in terms of best practices, but you can imagine the additional cost. There is a decrease in income because you won't have gate. But we, you know, there's still a low level of predictability. We've planned for four scenarios. So basically what we did is we have start of play within 3 months, 6 months, and 9 months, and then try and work out how that will impact on all our role players, from our affiliates right down to CSA income. But there is a low level of predictability. So we focus on return to work, return to train, and return to play. And the impact there of 3 months. So we've got outgoing tours. We don't, in all fairness, make a lot of money out of outgoing tours. It's income. You get your the bulk of your income from the Asian incoming tour. So that's under threat. But we also, of course, we're not an island. If our sponsors lose, the ability to honor sponsorship, it's problematic. And also signing up new sponsors. We lost Standard Bank, which is a big sponsor, and we've got to try and replace it. I think we've realized it won't be replaced at the same amount or at the same level. So this is how it will impact on us at this stage.
And at a high level, at ICC level, in terms of the future tours itinerary that's planned years ahead, does this mean that potentially there is a negotiation to be had at ICC level to replace some of those tours at a different date, or do we lose them altogether?
Yes, it's the future tour program is congested as it is. So we'd like to honour all outgoing tours as we would require them to honour the incoming tours. We also got a T20 scheduled in October. And of course, members needs that distribution. I do think that there will be a financial sacrifice, and you've got to reschedule it all. Everybody, of course, are keen to have then the Indian incoming tour, so that could be interesting to see how they schedule around that. We've had meetings with the ICC, but at this stage, again, you can scenario plan your international calendar as well. You probably fine for 3 months and even 6 months, as you can delay the FTP a little bit longer. But as it goes on, there's a lot of legal requirements in terms of the broadcaster as well. I'm with Mark on that. For us, 6 months is almost the crucial time in world cricket as well. If it goes past 6 months, we're going to have a problem, because what it will mean is you'll have to reschedule all bilateral cricket that didn't happen for 6 months, and it's already a congested space. So I think then you will have certain sacrifices needed to be made, and of course it will impact on your broadcast income.
Yeah, and that impacts the sports revenue directly. Richard, for tennis, I know Tennis South Africa has prepared a return to play proposal. What's the foundation of this plan? Obviously, tennis not a team sport, so it just makes intuitive sense that we should be allowing tennis before we go into things like team sport at this stage.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I mean, I think tennis is an individual sport versus a team sport. It's a non-contact sport versus a contact sport. So I think it has certain inbuilt advantages from a social distancing perspective compared to other sports out there. So we have made a very, very detailed proposal to the minister and the ministry and the Department of Sport, Arts and Culture. And it's really using international best practice in terms of where we are from a tennis guidelines and a health and safety perspective internationally, because there are actually a lot of countries now that have seen a return to play for tennis, not necessarily tournaments and events, but from a practicing, coaching, recreational perspective. So there's a lot of really good international practice out there that we would like to use in South Africa in the coming weeks.
And tennis is a big ecosystem when it comes to that cottage industry that I spoke of in the introduction. Mm. My brother-in-law just happens to be a tennis coach at Bryanston Country Club and hasn't been able to earn an income since the lockdown started. And as a sole proprietor, not many of the government programs like TERS, UIF benefits and others have really supported that sole proprietor in this space. So they're desperate to get back to work.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think around every sport, be it tennis, be it rugby, be it cricket, be it hockey, be it any other sport, there's a economic ecosystem around those sports. Sponsors, broadcasters, coaches, players, officials, service providers, equipment suppliers. And I'll give you one small example. You mentioned coaches, which is obviously a concern which I'll come to, but one small example is equipment suppliers. I mean, people don't realize, but the tennis ball market in South Africa is worth millions of rands. So you look at tennis, you add in all the other sports. We're talking about millions and millions and potentially billions of rands that are being impacted by the current crisis. I think the thing that does worry me is around coaches, and this applies not only to tennis but to other sports as well, particularly our grassroots coaches who can't earn a living at the moment. And my big worry is over the next few weeks and months, these coaches have to make a decision whether they continue practicing as coaches or whether they look for an alternative source of income. And what happens to sport across the country when we do eventually return to normal, whatever that looks like? Will we have coaches to actually educate a new generation of kids into our sports?
Absolutely.
So it's such a multifaceted and complex issue.
Absolutely.
That we're all dealing with as sports.
We're talking about the impact of COVID-19 on sport, and whichever way you look at it, you're playing on a sticky wicket, you're playing with a slippery ball here. I think all sporting codes are dealing with the unprecedented lockdown in their own way. We've got the head of Hockey South Africa, Marissa Langeni, in the room as well. And Marissa, my concern, I guess, from a hockey perspective as well, is what impact this has further down the line, which we haven't really touched on just yet, to club hockey in the country, which is such an important feeder into the system.
Absolutely. I mean, with club hockey being the main feeder into a lot of the national team and our high-performance structures, with nothing happening on the ground, every single day that we lose is a day that we're losing for high-performance sports. So a huge impact on our sport, a huge impact on our players, that obviously a lot of them play for those clubs and ply their trade within club structures.
Broadly speaking, how has hockey responded so far? What sort of plan is in place to ensure that we can get back to some form of play as quickly as possible?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a difficult space. And I mean, we recognize the fact that the issue around COVID-19 and the various alert levels that have been announced by the national government are quite fluid still at this stage. There's still talk on whether what will level 3 look like from a sporting structure perspective. We still have no indication at this stage whether a sport like hockey, which is a team sport and has a degree of contact, will be allowed to return to play at a level 3. So it is still early days for us. We're not too sure what that plan is going to look like. but we would like to start advocating for the return to practicing the sport. And we do believe that we can manage, you know, practicing the sport versus actually playing matches or having teams playing together in a competitive environment.
And a lot of the research, if you go back to look at parallels in history, very often sports strikes are the only thing that draw a parallel where you've shut down an entire sporting code. And if you don't have enough training pre-season and going back in, injury rates spike and all of that. Mark, the survey that I referenced from SASCOC earlier delivered some damning statistics. 89.8% of respondents surveyed didn't believe government was doing enough here. And I see the amount that's been put on the table for both sports and arts and culture of 150 million rand. That can't be enough.
Yeah, that's definitely not enough money for sport. You know, sport has always suffered when it came to the budget for the Department of Sport and Recreation. That is not enough. And the money the government's getting, it's actually for individuals. It is not actually for bigger sports codes who have teams. So we cannot access that funds to assist some of our development players and stuff like that. Now, it's certainly for earmarked for certain, it's got a certain criteria.
What else is government doing to assist you here?
We currently, the only assistance they can give us right now is assistance to get us to get permission for us to play our professional rugby. We've decided not to play any amateur club rugby, only the professional sports where we have contractual commitments. And the protocols putting that in place, you know, the medical facilities and stuff, it costs a fortune. So you cannot do it at a community level. It can only be done at a professional level. And then finding one venue only to play all your games at one venue so that you can sanitize that venue properly on a regular basis.
It'll be unfortunate for those who might have contractual agreements around performance to lose home ground advantage. I think it might be difficult to go and look through contracts to say, well, we said we'd perform at X level, but we weren't playing at home. I can see that kind of conversation emerging.
I know it's tough, but you know we're living in extraordinary times, and we need to do different things just to get back onto the field. I know it's tough. Our calendar is a different calendar because our calendar dovetails with the international calendar. When we move a competition, it doesn't only move in South Africa, it moves throughout the world. All our franchise competitions and our national competitions have to be realigned in the world. So we're constantly in meetings with World Rugby trying to adjust the international calendar based on what countries are saying.
And we've seen today that the July tests at international level have been delayed at this stage. Do you think they'll be played this year?
Well, the proposal is to move it to October, to play inbounds in October and outbounds in November. But, you know, who knows how the various governments open their borders and stuff. And if you have to go into quarantine for 2 weeks before in your country and 2 weeks when you arrive in that country, it's a month out of a player, you know, you won't be match fit to play.
Now, these are the practical concerns. On the issue of government support, Richard, do you think government's been sympathetic to what TNSSA has proposed?
I think the important point to stress is that there's no rule book for this. I mean, the rule book's being written at the moment, so, and we're all sort of involved in the writing of the rule book. I think governments, in terms of the department, have been accessible and willing to listen. And I think they're in the process of formulating a more detailed proposal, not just for, or a response, not just for tennis, but for all sports from a guidelines perspective. But I would urge more urgency. I do think there needs to be more urgency because of some of the points that a number of people on the Zoom call have discussed. I think time is really running out for sports federations, but also the wider sports ecosystem as well. I think it's going to be a desperate situation in the coming months unless there's more urgency.
Jacques, I believe the presentations were made in front of the Sports Portfolio Committee over the last week, and the Portfolio Committee told the department to go back and think a little bit more deeply about things. So that doesn't seem to inspire a lot of confidence from a government perspective.
I think we're fortunate that we have a bit of time, you know, to deal with it and to learn out of other cricket federations worldwide and how they return to play effectively. your biggest question for me is the question of liability. So you can imagine if a participant or even somebody that just works in sport would be negatively affected by contracting the virus. So liability is a big issue for us, and we've got to deal with that in a very responsible way. So it is a balance between acting very responsible and getting our financial vulnerability to be mitigated in a certain way. I ever think that people don't understand the sport ecosystem, and it may be the way that the industry is reflected. And I want to take up where Richard mentioned that the ecosystem is much bigger. You know, so if I host a match, there's caterers, there's a cleaning company, there's a security company, and you might argue, look, they also have access to you know, the funds that's made available. But the ecosystem and the data that's provided to ring fence the sports industry, to my mind, is useful data, but definitely not a true reflection of our influence. I do think that sport as an industry puts much more meals on much more or many more plates than yeah. people think.
Yeah.
And you almost sense that you know, people don't take us that seriously, isn't it? I had somebody said the other day, why don't you just play you know, at the later stage? But it would be a massive effect. Even broadcasters, people working in live sports, to journalists. The ecosystem is a little bit bigger than we think. We've reached out to other sports. Richard's in the fortunate position that he has a very good understanding of our sports cricket finance as well. I've been talking to Yuri. Mark would be happy to know that. I do think that we got to have an individual approach, but also a collective approach to it. And I think it might be a time for us to quantify the industry and the impact the industry's got on the economy, but I'm not so sure those numbers reflect it. Now, of course, in the past, these data didn't bother us, but now it's become crucial because I think people got to realize the economic impact. But I also think on the psyche of the country, live sport, and what they miss out on in terms of what it can do for a country. So if you're stuck at your home and you can't even, you know, access live sport, the big effect of that. Sport's such a powerful tool. And I think, in a way, we've got to step that fight up collectively as well.
And at the same time, Mark, to bring you in on this point, we've got to ensure that we retain our top players. And just today there was an announcement that the Lions have had to say goodbye to the likes of Malcolm Marks and a few other top players under what has been set up with the Lions structures there. What is SARU doing to ensure that we retain players who might want to go and play in other countries that are opening up their leagues ahead of ours?
We try and make the game as attractive as possible and playing back at home, but you know, we cannot compete with the yen, dollar and the pound. It's very, very difficult. We try and keep as many players as possible in the country. It's tough. We compete internationally. We play in five different countries every year. That's where we play our rugby. We don't play locally. Our franchises play abroad. Mm. One thing we don't take into account when we talk about sport is the economic impact. You know, next year we have the British and Irish Lions Tour that's coming here. The economic impact for that tour to the economy will be 6.8 billion. Similar to the Indian tour of cricket. Now, we don't take into sport does play a major role as far as the economy is concerned. You know, 6% of our economy comes from tourism. And a large portion of that is sports tourism.
So to Jacques' point then, perhaps time to get together, put your resources together and do a comprehensive ecosystem study and analysis of the economic contributions to South Africa of all the sporting codes. Is what SASCOC should be doing. I don't want to get sidetracked by some of the leadership goings on at SASCOC. I think those are well documented. Marissa, just as we get to the end of our conversation here, what would you like to see from government to help the various sporting bodies, hockey included, get players back on the field? Perhaps we might not be able to do it with big crowds, but we can do it behind closed doors like the Bundesliga is doing, and ensure that we at least satisfy commitments to broadcasters and sponsors as well to keep the sports alive.
Absolutely. We would like to see, you know, the ecosystem of sport being kept alive. and making sure that, that people remain in jobs and making sure that we comply with exactly what the president of the country has been talking about. Keep people employed, keep people in jobs, make sure that at the end of the day, you know, nobody is a victim of this COVID-19, that there is a controllable. We'd love to see a more concerted effort, a collaborative effort with our Department of Sport, Arts and Culture to ensure that we do exactly that. You mentioned the relief funding that was announced. We've been very appreciative of that, but 150 million is not going to take us very far. I mean, I've done the sums. If you look at the 473 applicants that have applied at a capped amount of 20,000 per individual, that's 9.4 million that will end up in the hands of sportsmen and women, as opposed to the 150 million that has been announced. So for me, that is not sufficient. It's also been a very niche criteria that only looks at one sector. And I mean, all my colleagues have spoken about, there is an entire ecosystem that keeps the sporting fraternity alive, and no one is looking after that ecosystem. The engine rooms, they don't even know where we work from. You know, so the engine rooms, nobody cares about that. So it's important. We want a collaborative effort. We want a more round table discussion as to how we keep national federations afloat, how we keep our unions afloat, and make sure that at the end of the day, when we have won this battle against COVID-19, we can return back to the field of play.
Well, Marissa, very well put. Thank you very much. That was the CEO of Hockey SA, Marissa Langeni, who's joined by Mark Alexander, president of SARU, Jacques Fall, acting CEO of Cricket South Africa, and Richard Glover, CEO of Tennis SA. For now, I think Mabel and Olive will have to do.